Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today you're going to hear a conversation between my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, the Numinous CEO, Peyton Nyquist, and the musician, East Forest. This conversation was recorded in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest, right after these guys finished up a panel discussion. They talk about the many facets of music and the important role it plays in the psychedelic therapy process, reflect on some questions that were asked during their panel at South by Southwest, and then dive into East's journey with making music specifically for psychedelic therapy. Quick plug for the unique training opportunities that Numinous has for mental health practitioners who want to develop an expertise in psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. You can click the link below that will take you to our training page, or you can go directly to numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. We just wrapped up one round of our 8-week course on the fundamentals of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. We'll be starting a new one soon. So go check out that course and the other courses that we have on tap on the menu at numinous.com/training. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to our show, by leaving us a review or a rating wherever you listen, in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And of course, you can share this episode with someone who's an East Forest fan or a psychedelic fan or a Reed Robison fan or a Good Conversation fan, etc., etc. Please enjoy today's episode.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to be here with you both.
Yeah.
Peyton and East Forest, what a treat to be here together in Austin for South by Southwest, doing a podcast on location.
Looking down out the window here at the remnants of last night.
Yes. Night one. South by Southwest shrapnel down on.
Yeah, this. Yeah, they're just getting started.
Yeah.
Yeah, the city has been invaded by people, hasn't it?
I think it's really, I mean, it's interesting. Yesterday, kind of day one, seeing the psychedelic track and having like a dedicated psychedelic track at South by Southwest was
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, they didn't have that in the past.
Yeah.
Maybe we could recap a little bit how the panel went, because that was a full house and really good feedback.
Yeah.
About the whole experience, from your meditation and flute at the beginning to the conversation you moderated.
Yeah. Overarchingly, it was so cool to see the appreciation of what we were talking about. And, even the questions, like I felt there was this really good inquiry around how do you prioritize, you know, there's this excitement around psychedelics becoming, you know, legally available, psychedelic therapy becoming legally available, but this really, like, to me felt like a very informed conversation around, like, how do we actually build, yeah, it's great that they're becoming available from a research standpoint, but how do you answer, at least in my mind, the really challenging question of, like, how do you build a container that can be accessible for everybody, but also intimate and personalized and supportive as well. So I thought that was pretty cool.
No, those questions were really genuine. And there's a mixture of, like, people really asking questions about, like, I don't know, proper usage and right livelihood, very personal. And there was also kind of questions about how do we merge this into technology or apps or business and commerce in ways that make sense. And so it's like, it wasn't just people thinking, like, how can I turn this into a business, but more like, how do I do it in a right way? Mm-hmm. Or like, how do I do it personally in a way that feels right? And that was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have, I felt the one question at the end, the woman who asked about, like, creating a reverence or creating like a intention. And I think that can feel so, there's just a lot to that question. How do you be respectful? How do you build ceremony around that? And I think there's a lot of, like, a lot of nervousness, I think, for people in regards to, like, we don't want to culturally appropriate, we want to, you know, but how do you feel about that? You know, even your music is, I always find it's super respectful and very open for a lot of different people. So,
I mean, I think I came up in a different, like, things changed a lot in the last few years,
yeah.
and the kind of woke revolution we've gone through has educated us a lot too. But I mean, back when I was doing this, I was just on my own, just trying to figure out things that worked for myself and going to various forms of indigenous ceremonies for my own development personally and spiritually, and also to learn. I didn't know any other way to learn than to just go and experience and learn from direct experience of the medicine. You know, I was talking to Xochitl Ashe, a medicine woman, a few weeks ago, and she was talking about her initiation. And she's fifth generation medicine worker with psilocybin. Maybe it goes back more generations. That's all I know. And she says, you know, the initiation comes from the medicine itself.
Right.
And that's how it is. And I was just thinking for myself, I don't consider myself a medicine man, but I'm saying whatever I was learning, really, that's primarily where it was from. And it was just kind of letting it inform your life and honoring everyone that I would experience and work with, but not trying to just say, like, I'm going to take this piece and this piece. It's just sort of, it's art in the end, right? So it's just informing. You kind of put that into your own artistic expression. But anyway, I think that woman who asked that question about, you know, how do I make this feel right or reverent? There was a sense of shame I could feel in her question. And I think the answer was a lot about keeping it simple and authentic is more than enough. It's like 90% of it is just even just taking a minute to be like offering something or just giving thanks, just acknowledging who you are and what you're working with. And it's just sort of like taking stock of like not being unconscious, it's just being conscious. And anytime you express a form of gratitude to something other than yourself, it not only is that polite, but I think it does something to you.
For sure.
You know, it reorients on unconscious levels. Like it helps you kind of get to a space of like non-hubris, which is a good place to be moving into things that are probably more powerful than your mind.
I love what you shared about that. The question being like, how do I use medicines personally with intention? And that stance of gratitude turning into receptivity. And then what Charlotte shared too, like you said, about keeping it simple. Like just put some intention around it, which may mean lighting a candle, saging the room.
Yeah.
If those are true for you, it may mean writing down an intention with openness, something like that.
Yeah, ceremony can be simple. Maybe it probably should be.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. Why not?
Well, and I think the, you know, it's interesting. I've seen this too. Like the at times that trying to make it super complex, there's a little bit of like a control aspect to that too. If I'm focusing all my intention on building this complexity or sophistication, there's a little bit of like, I can also hide there a little bit as well.
Yeah.
I remember I was similarly talking to a Shipibo ayahuasca provider and very long lineage of that practice. And I was asking him about, you know, how do you feel about appropriation or Westerners coming down and, you know, sitting with ayahuasca and how do we do that in a good way? And he kind of laughed at me and he was like, what a interesting kind of human egotistical thing to think that you're even in control of these plants. Like these plants have been here way before humans have, and they'll probably be here way, way after. And right now your culture's or your humanity is going through a need at the moment. And so don't, you know, while yes, there's this needing to make sure that there's reciprocity paid and sustainability paid, don't think that you're necessarily driving the bus either. And that was kind of an interesting reframe.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. I like that. And it brings up a question I've had for a while, and I bet others are wondering, like, because I encountered your music before I was even deep in the psychedelic world through the yoga community. And both when I'd go practice yoga and then teach yoga, your songs would come up on people's playlists or in yoga classes all the time. And I'm wondering, if that was intentional. And like, what's your origin story with the music? Why did you start doing this and how has it evolved?
Well, it's funny that the yoga community picked it up first, and blessings to all my yogi community out there. I started this very specifically in the psychedelic realm for myself. And the yoga community was the first to pick it up. And that wasn't like intentional. I just noticed that they're seekers, a lot of, and in a sense, the psychedelic track is about seeking too. So they saw the common ground. And back then, I wasn't saying so much about what it was about. It felt more dangerous to really talk about it. It really did. I mean, it's 2008. I just, there were not websites. There was Reality Sandwich. This was, they couldn't even get advertisers beyond like bongs and stuff. Yeah. Because it was like, and you didn't touch it. It was like, oh, you don't talk about psychedelics and you're going to be like sidelined. So even in the music world, I was a little like, I would talk around it, or I'd put little images to kind of give hints to people. And it was slower for it to be picked up in the psychedelic world because of that, because you couldn't just be like, this is what it's for, and this is how I do it, and here's how I suggest using it. And everything we were doing in private circles was in the total underground. And that's really all it was. There was no public performance element besides those private circles. So God bless to the yoga world, because it gave me an opportunity to slowly build an audience, a very small, tight-knit audience. And that gave me the opportunity to go out and play some shows and start to build something very, very, very slowly. And it wasn't until 2018 where I had released records that had been recorded in psilocybin ceremonies that were thought to be for that work, but I still had edited down the ceremony to like an album length, like whatever, an hour, 45 minutes. And there'd be like five songs. So I have albums like Prana, or Music to Die To, Music to Be Born To, Crystal Starship. Those are all from ceremonies that we were doing.
Live,
improvised, just psilocybin circles. But I never said that. And then 2018, I was finally like, you know, I feel like it's time. I feel like it's okay to be a little more open about it and release the whole thing. So I did, I was like, I'm gonna call it Music for Mushrooms. I mean, how more explicit can you get? Yeah. So 5 hours, and I did that, Music for Mushrooms. We just recorded a ceremony. And then when it took about a year for it to finish it, it came out. And when it came out, like 2 weeks later, the Oakland Initiative happened and Denver. And everyone said, in Michael Pollan's book, and I was like, oh, yeah, you know, great timing. It's like, this is the mushrooms. This is it. Right. I mean, like, I just kind of was listening to the wavelengths. I was like, okay, I guess it's the time. And I don't really feel in charge of that, you know? You feel like there's these things happening, and we're all just in service to, it's just about paying attention and trying to be in service to a wave.
That's amazing. So that was your psychedelic coming out of the closet, kind of.
Fully, yeah. Before then, I would talk about it more and more, but I never was saying, like, this is how we did it, you know? People took mushrooms, I took mushrooms, played music.
I love that, listening to the wavelengths. And so you started music in 2008, started making it for
this project, East Forest, and even that was unintentional. So I've been doing music for 20 years. It's like hustling, trying to like do it, you know. And before that, it was all in school my whole life. But I told that story briefly yesterday. It was really a time, if you remember back to 2008, when there was a lot of collapse happening. I mean, the financial collapse was pretty serious.
Yeah.
And there's a deep recession that happened. And I was a photographer as my day job. And so like that was very tied to the economy. It's kind of like if companies and people didn't have extra money, they're like, we don't really need the nice
need photos
pictures right now. Yeah. And so it was a harder time. And I've been pushing a band for a long time, that for like 5 years. And, you know, it's like indie pop kind of piano thing. And it just wasn't ever like going anywhere. And it wasn't very good. But at the time, it was my thing. But all that was collapsing. So everything was collapsing in my life and in the world. And I took that opportunity to make a new kind of music for myself that was for the first time, just what I wanted to hear and for fun. And I wanted to use it with mushrooms because I'd had a couple experiences in my life, like less than a half a dozen, that just magically, like there were these moments where I was listening to music and I had a mushroom experience that was just so profound and amazing and just felt like I touched something that I'd always knew existed. We all feel like there's more, and you finally feel these experiences sometimes. And that was, I wanted to get back there. I wanted to reverse engineer it. And I didn't have any other, there were no movies or websites or retreats about like, yeah, go to this ayahuasca thing. Or I was like, I don't know. I guess I'll just try and figure it out. And I didn't, so I would read as much as I could about sound healing, new tech, anything, brain entrainment, binaural, anything I could find. And then I would go to ceremonies and kind of experience the old technology. And I was just really just mashing all that together to try and get to that space again. And after a year of making a record for myself that was not meant to be commercialized in any way, and I had a very powerful experience with it, and it really just birthed something new. And even at that time, what it birthed in me was very personal. It just felt like I personally had gone through a kind of Rubicon or change. I didn't know that would turn into anything public or a job, because I thought it, I honestly thought it couldn't. I was like, this isn't even a genre. It's ambient. It's long form. I mean, there's no place for it in the music industry. So then the yoga industry is like, thank God.
Yeah. Which album was that?
The Education of the Individual Soul.
Cool.
So this is guy, Court Johnson, who speaks the 10 laws, and he speaks at the end of the album. He's a elder and teacher and mystic and wild man in Santa Barbara. And I, the 10 Law song was the first song I recorded. And I had visited him and I was recording a bunch of stuff and recorded him talking. He said that. And I remember going home and I was just playing with that four on the floor beat. And I was trying to find like, what are the chords that like have that feeling I'm looking for? You know, and I found there was those two, three chords on the Fender Rhodes. It's like, oh, there it is. That's the like middle path groove feeling, not happy, not sad. And I remember remembering that recording. I just dropped the needle on him talking, and I heard him over the music. I was like, that's cool. That's kind of like this universal message, hunter-gatherer thing. And I just unfolded. And looking back, it feels like the mushrooms kind of coaxing it along without even realizing, like they're pulling the strings of a marionette in a way. I still feel that way.
So then when it's done, a year later, you listen to it.
Yeah.
On mushrooms.
Yeah. Yes, no, I was inspired by mushrooms, so I thought I should probably honor that. And it was a very small ceremony without me really realizing what I was doing. And I just set some time aside, like on a Saturday. It was in mid-September. And I took some mushrooms and I went on a walk and came back when they started to kick in. And I had my bed and the headphones, put on headphones, and I hit play and it's like lay back. I'm like, all right, let's listen to this record. But the medicine really had kicked in. And it allowed me to separate myself from the creator as just the experiencer. And it was just a completely magical moment. I mean, in many ways, what we're all talking about, how music aligns with psychedelics, and I had an intuition about that. And now I feel like that's like my bread and butter. But at the time, I was still just kind of like, is that a thing? Or it was a maybe. And it happened in a big way, a big way, where there's like this weaving, because the whole record's one 45-minute thing.
Yeah.
And it weaves with these field recordings of nature, but also everywhere I'd been the last year, because I was doing all these field recordings. And there are all the people I'd talked to, and my parents, and the places I'd been, and the nature spots that were really powerful to me. And it just all was like, almost like I tricked myself into this journey, but a really profound journey. I mean, all this crazy shit, like, I did this little field recording. I was out on this Block Island, which is near outside New York City. And I was playing a gig with my old band. Terrible gig. Terrible gig. I remember like thinking so depressed. Like, this is one of the worst experiences of my life. I'm over. I'm a loser. Like, it's just so bad. And I'd taken like ferry to get there, you know. No one's there. And afterwards, I'd walked around. I found this little labyrinth. And there were these two little girls in the labyrinth. One was like five and one was like three, and they're sisters. And whatever the 5-year-old said, the 3-year-old would repeat. And it was so cute. And I was walking the labyrinth just like secretly, just recording them. And I did this stuff all the time, recording people secretly.
Cool.
Yeah.
And they were saying all these cute things. And they got to the middle of the labyrinth. And the sister, the five-year-old said like, you know, Aubrey, we got there. We're there. And the little one said, we got there. We're there. Which is nothing, right? But this was at the end of the album. And I remember I was, and that was like a terrible day in my life. And then in the album, I got to this moment at the end and I heard the girls say like, you got there, you're there. And she's like, you got it. It's like little leprechauns. And it meant to me like in your life, it's like, you've gotten to this moment. Are you ready to like let it all go and be something new? And it just was like, and I was like, and that was a moment where like my ego is so like destroyed, of course. But the meaning, there's lots of moments like that or weavings from the life, and I was actually hearing them became like a soul awakening. And it was just the most beautiful thing that had ever happened to me. And it just felt so clearly like something larger had been working through all of my sticky human ego stuff, like that moment, to help me make something so that I could like open my heart. And after that moment, I just felt like that was enough. I mean, that was so beautiful. And it changed me. Like that was like the whole purpose. Like that could have been East Forest and that was the end of it. And that would be the best thing. But it just, I gave it that album to other people just as a gift and sharing. Mm-hmm. And it really started to do the same thing for other people. And that was really kind of confusing at first because I thought this is so literally about, it's my mother and my life in there. But they were like, on journeys like talking to their dead father or my roommate from Jamaica, and it's like cultural differences. And then a friend started saying, we're going to make ceremonies out of this album, and then maybe you can play a little bit around it because it's short. I'm like, are you crazy? I don't know, I can't do that. And he's like, it's this Saturday. You know, and I'm like, all right. And he just kept setting them up and kept setting up. And then it was like 40 people a weekend. We started building our protocol and I started looping. And it just became like, you just learn and it gets better and better and better and clearer. 6-7 years of that. And it became more of like, we have kind of a musical sound that's just like, this is our path. We still couldn't really talk about it. And then, you fast forward from 2008, 10 years of that kind of work in our own little lab, thousands of people from New York, our community. And we had a way, you know, and is that built on the past? Absolutely. But we are so kind of also isolated. It felt very, like American really. And I was very interested in how do we create a process to take people through this experience. And this was psilocybin with music primarily as our main mechanism and ceremony being protocol or just what is that structure you do it in, even how you, what you say, what you don't say, how you ask them to prepare. That's the most effective. That's the most positive, the least traumatic, the most, and that was our only litmus test. And so we just didn't have a lot of other people to talk to or, you know, bring in. And it was just very much real world. Okay, that didn't work so well. Let's try this next time. We just try different things.
I think that the one thing you touched on, like that really personal connection. And for me, like, and I'm sure for a lot of people, music is this like deeply personal expression that is also so universal for people.
Also. Yeah, and very human.
And I think that, you know, when I think about even therapists, right? Like the deeply healing moments I've had in psychedelic therapy, even in ceremony, is not it's those intimate moments of like being seen, right? Like really authentically being seen and like, oh, I'm connecting with this person because they've been there too, right? And that universal moment of like the letting go of like, oh yeah, that's my suffering on an individual level, but I don't have to hold that all by myself because it is also universal as well. And there's one of the most interesting kind of experiences I had that even on the last tour that you did, you know, I got the chance to be in about six or seven of those those performances.
You're at a lot. You're always in the same place.
In hindsight, but there's a moment where I believe it's your grandmother that's in that and speaking, and you're having that conversation with her around music and her losing, it was her hearing, right? Mm-hmm. And in every single one of those performances I was at, when that part of the performance would come on, you would hear all these people just start to go like,
you know?
And it was this like super intimate moment that you were having with your grandmother, but it just brought this connection point for everybody in different ways, but that intimate connection allowed for that space to be created for everybody as well. And I thought that was really such a cool thing to see and experience.
It's also kind of a mundane moment for my grandma in some ways, right? It's just like a phone call where your grandma's just sort of like, well, here's what I'm doing and here's what I'm thinking about. And she's being very vulnerable. But I also really like those moments that feel really mundane and you get to amplify them through art, whether it's just like a cricket in a tree that normally would just walk by.
Right.
But you take that and you isolate it or put it in a song somehow, and now it's like, whoa, now there's more there. Or just the wind or simple things, I think, is beautiful when they can combine to make something more emotional.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, even in the psychedelic space too, right? Like when you're in those ceremonies and you'll have these epiphanies or what have you, and you'll grab your journal and you'll be like, I finally got it. And you'll write it down and be like, I got to come back to that later when this is, and you'll open your book being like, oh, I got the thing. And you'll open it up and it'll be like, you should love yourself more.
Yeah, it's like a circle. Yeah. It's like, that was the answer.
That was the answer.
It's just now we've like, I can't go.
It's a beautiful lesson in mindfulness. No, like an experience of it, though. Like taking a moment and expanding it, like zooming into it and just feeling it fully. I think it's so beautiful. Mm. Such a reminder to do that as we walk through life and, you know, whether it's smelling a flower, doing the dishes, or taking out the trash, you know. Mm. But those recordings are so special. I remember you talking in your concert series when you passed through Utah, the one I went to, about visiting Ram Dass and doing some recordings. And he's one of my dearest teachers I never met. Like, I cannot count the number of hours and talks I've spent and tears shed from his words. So I'm wondering, how did that come to be, and what's his role in your life?
Well, it was the same for me. He was just a really powerful influence from afar, from mostly listening to talks and some of his books. So I just felt that that was also 2018. I just felt that it would be, it's just sort of like you're picking up on ideas or things in the wavelength. I thought it would be a really good project to do, and it was very clear to me like what it could be. And I just felt, I was like, I could do this, and I know what I want it to be. And I had experience recording people and putting it to music and how you edit the words and the timing with the music. So thankfully they said yes. So, you know, how it came to me is pretty basic, but there was like, looking back, there were some things that it was almost like there's a cosmic joke to it too, you know, and some weavings of like, his teacher Maharaji was someone that I started to toy around with, working with after a divorce, and looking back when I finally opened up to him, kind of saying, hey man, I don't know, like if you can help out, I need help, so do your thing.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, I was sitting with Ram Dass and the door shuts and, you know, they hit record, and it finally like gotten to that place. And there were many opportunities where it could have not happened. And then it hit me hard that, oh, this is beyond my finagling or the right email that I wrote or whatever. Like there's same thing of the mushrooms pulling the strings. Yeah. It's really that when I say that, or I say Maharaji even, to me, it's all the same thing. It's just, let's call it what you want. Just like the great I am, the universe, God, the mushroom, the guru. It's like the larger art piece that is coalescing. That's not just, I think, like I've manipulated it myself.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So you flew out to Hawaii.
To Maui, yeah.
Yeah, where Ram Dass was post-stroke.
Oh, yeah. He'd been out there at that point probably 15, 18 years since he had a stroke. Yeah.
And recorded
Yeah,
those
we were
words
there
from
for
him.
about a week, and I didn't know if he would be having a bad day, and I couldn't talk because of his aphasia. And that was just a rolling of the dice. But I thought it was worth it. And I told Raghu, who's the executive director of the foundation, I said, look, man, I mean, let's say even if it doesn't work and I end up having to use recordings from the past, and there's a lot of those, but I like to record my own stuff because I feel like that's the colors I'm being given to paint with in a way. Whether it's a leaves in a tree or like all the field recordings I've used are primary ones I've recorded. And I said, I gotta at least look him in the eye if I'm making his own legacy to music and just be like, okay, this is happening. All right. And then that would be enough. And he agreed. But thankfully, Ram Dass, we were only recorded 2 days and then hung out a couple more days, but only 2 days of recording. And I got probably a couple hours. And the second sitting, he was really struggling, but he loves to talk. And then, like a lot of old guys or old women, like love to tell stories. Like he loves, tell me about the thing and thing. And I remember one of the last ones we did is it turned into this song called A Miracle, which he tells the story of meeting Maharaji for the first time. Okay, that song's like 8 minutes. That took about an hour and a half to get out because of all the pauses. And I know that story. So when he started the story, I was like, oh man, this is a long one. Like, I hope we, I really, because I knew the punchline was the miracle moment where Maharaji essentially reads his mind. And I said, if we don't get there, none of this is, I can't really use it, you know? And so I was kind of like, oh man, can we please get there? And not wanting someone to, end it and open the door. And Radha was there for the second one. And she's sort of doing the like Jedi forces on the door, like nobody come in.
Don't let lunch come in
Yeah,
right
exactly.
now.
Because, well, they're very protective of him, which is
Sure.
good. Just like he's okay, this is too much, or it's been too long. But he was having a great time. He loved it. He was just back in his recliner, and we had this really nice mic right here, and just telling us stories.
This tattoo I have right here was pulled from Maharaji's notebook of writing Ram 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 1,000
Oh,
times,
nice,
Ram
nice.
Dass's guru,
Yeah.
just as a reminder of that, what you were just saying about it's all the same, you know, whether it's guru or the mushroom or love or I am loving awareness.
Like you are the guru. Yeah. Yeah, it's a mind trip, and I think that's kind of the point, like a Zen koan or something. It's supposed to break the gears, and that's the doorway into
Yeah.
more.
And I love that play on words that is, I am loving awareness. I'm loving it and I am it. Because what we were talking about earlier, the yogis are seekers, psychedelic journeyers are seekers. But there's this Yoga Sutra that I've always loved that says, at some point, the seeker becomes the seer. Like at some point in your album, you saw it, you didn't know why you were doing it. And then the seeker becomes a seer. And I think those moments happen in our lives. They're so special.
Yeah.
I think that one person I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of learning from this conversation around seekers. And I think we're in this, you know, even being here, there's a lot of that seeking. And there's this doing aspect to that. And one of my teachers, he says, seeking is great, but I want to help the finding. And I want to try and, you know, so this remembrance of like, yes, we can always be like the ever evolving commitment to seeking, but also not forgetting to find as well. And you know, you talked about like finding that awareness, whether it's like doing the dishes or all of those things too, like giving ourselves the permission to recognize that too, right?
Yeah, because we can burn ourselves out in the seeking or get caught in. You know, what does Ram Dass say? All tools can be traps. You know, the seeking can just go on endlessly. But the truth is that inside somewhere, we're already awake, we're already free, we already are loving awareness. We forget it though, you know.
I'm curious going to what you were mentioning at the beginning of your story, and you know, making that music and not being able to talk about psychedelics. And now, full circle, there's a psychedelic track at South by Southwest. Yeah. There's clinics, there's, you know, clinical trials,
podcasts.
So it's now almost like, you know, come full circle in a way. What is that? I mean, maybe one, what does that feel like to like know your music and these like very intimate personal moments are now helping and supporting a lot of people in their own, you know, journey? What's that experience like?
It's the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I guess on a like surface level, it feels like a vindication of like, I remember doing those weekends with people in upstate New York and coming back to New York to my place and telling some certain friends. I was just talking to one of them the other day, one of my old college friends, and she's like, asking about they're going to South By and there's a psychedelic track, and she's like, oh yeah. And I was like, do you remember when I came back from one of those weekends, I remember telling you about the weekend and you just looking so like quizzical and like, what? You guys are crazy. Like, what are you, just a bunch of people taking drugs up in the upstate? And like, people, that is just immediate judgment, you know? And so it's, but that first record, I was giving it away for free. I still do, not that people care as much about downloading anymore, but like I threw that record in the Library of Congress to make it like permanent. I was so dedicated to like it being a gift, because it gave me so much. As like, how dare I have to do that. I just felt like so clear. It's like, this has to be disseminated in a way that it's free, like free energetically too. And I try to keep that spirit of the gift in mind moving forward, and keep that as a real like branch of, or like root of this tree, because I think that's like the underpinning of what's happening. That friction between commerce and the psychedelic movement, whatever that is, you're trying to put a circle in a square, but we need to, and it's okay to, in order to like, it's like you want the stuff to filter through the systems that exist, which is the dominant paradigm. But at the same time, we don't want to lose sight of the magic that can happen and the abundance that can happen when you loosen that grip a bit to the gift.
It's interesting. And I think about this in regards to therapists, and there's a lot of people who even underground do, you know, for a long time have been doing this, you know, not for any kind of compensation. And a lot of them, you know, were people who were risking, you know, these are illegal substances. They're taking a lot of risks. Some of them, you know, had some kind of regulated profession before. But also, and this is the thing that I talk about too, is like, while I love that, I also, the last thing I would want someone who's supporting me in that space thinking like, I'm loving doing this, I'm offering this, and I'm worried about how I'm going to pay my rent.
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely.
Like, I want someone to be able to be there fully. And even for me as the participant, I want to make a commitment, an energetic exchange, whether that's money or whatever. I want to make an exchange so that is reciprocal and
sustainable.
Sustainable, yeah. Committing to that sustainability as well. So it's messy. Well,
and we were talking about this yesterday. Like when I did that and that album was out there, and even when I started to release, even in 2018 with Music for Mushrooms and stuff, there were less opportunities to commercialize.
Right.
And so I just never thought that would even be in the picture. I really didn't. And so it was always going to be the underground / just individuals. Like, I wanted to give tools that had helped me and helped my community, because maybe they'll help you. And I thought, in some ways, cracking that code of digital tools that can really help guide us and be replicable and free like that, that was, I thought, very, very needed. But I did not anticipate that there would be clinics or retreats happening that are high, you know, thousands of dollars, sometimes one session being $1,000 or maybe more. And they would play that same album, receive that money, and then the musician gets none. And of course that rubs you the wrong way, but I still have the piece in me. It's like, well, you know, I get abundance other ways and I'm helping that person and that's good. But I really think about the future of this work and other artists, and how do you convince them to come into this space? Because we need more voices artistically in the space, and I very much believe in people making bespoke works that are long form to cover a whole journey, which I think is way better than a playlist.
Yeah,
way better and needed. And but we have to find a financial incentive to say, like you're saying, so that people can be like, it makes sense for me to put a year into making a record like that.
Yeah.
So as an example, yesterday morning, I was on a meeting with a group of therapists. We're planning a group ketamine program that starts next month. And the topic came up of what music do we use for these, say, two-hour dosing sessions that happen three times in the six-week program. And first of all, kudos to Peyton for setting up the company culture this way of like, everyone said we cannot, will not use Spotify because it doesn't support the musicians in that way. And in a clinic that's existing in the commercial world, you know, but has vision, mission, values. And everyone also said, East Forest, how do we use that and get something that has the arc of the journey represented? And maybe that's a chance as an example to tell people, what would you recommend? You know, when we can't have you live in every clinic every time, or and you don't want to drop in random songs, you want to support the music, what does one do?
Well, Neumann is one of the only, not only, but few companies that recognizes that and prioritizes it and then supports it. And you guys have been going outside of just the clinical space and things like the tour and other ways, and like what we just did yesterday, like let's have a talk about it, let's have the conversation, and that's important. I started a company called Journey Space that was trying to fix this problem of providing this sort of music that's very turnkey, lots of different kinds of it in different lengths, from 2 hours to 4 hours to 6 hours, and it's currently just my music. And it also provides the right license so that you are covered for its commercial use. It's just a gray, well, it's not really gray, but it's an area that hasn't quite been covered. For instance, like when yoga studios or restaurants play music, there's already a system in play for performance rights to cover that revenue. And it's just, there is a system and it's kind of known. Many yoga studios don't pay it. They're supposed to, but most restaurants, they figure out there's ways to do it. It's not a huge fee, but that's the way it's done. And that's the way the songwriter and the master rights holder are get their little piece. So you think, like, has that been established now for people doing clinical use, or are all these retreats happening, which is commercial too?
Yeah.
And it hasn't. There's no actual organization yet that's figured out, well, this is the rate. It could be the same performing rights organizations. That'd probably be the simplest. But they're just like, it's probably not even on the radar because it's a fairly small thing, right? But as it grows, we need to figure that out. And I just think, you know, what are the main components to most journeys? It's a good one. And music's probably one of the three pillars of it, aside from the place you're at, or the medicine itself, the place, and the practitioner. And the music. And for me, at least, when I journey, that's all there is this music and whatever protocols around that. So it just blows my mind that I'll talk to people who are running, let's say, a private retreat somewhere. And they'll say, like, oh, we're doing 12 retreats a month. We're using your music for all of it. It's amazing. Thank you so much. And I'm thinking, like, and they never have even thought, like, oh, like, there's a value to that music financially. And it's like, I'm like, man, and I've tried to work with some artists to bring them in this space, and they're really eager to do it. I think artistically, they're really excited about it because it's almost like you can do anything you want. You can play for a long time, and you can create in these new ways. And but we don't live in a world, we live in a streaming world, and it's hard to break the convenience, which I understand, of like, well, I have my Spotify stuff, but I want to convince them that also, just using playlists, like, there are lots of advantages to beyond just the playlist. None of that music was designed for that work. When I work with playlists myself as an experiment, I feel like every time a new song comes in, a new artist, it's like a new soul comes in the room, and I have to kind of reorient. And there's a real value to, like, a single artistic voice taking you with an arc through an experience. And that's how it's been done forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we're almost epigenetically used to that. There's a comfort, and which all of this is not just like, I think it's better. It's also like, I think it makes a more positive journey because there's a comfort level there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's again, going back to like what works. We would have used playlists probably back when we were doing that stuff upstate New York, but I played live and improvised and all, and because we just found it worked better. Mm. It was a ton of work, but it worked mm-hmm. better.
Yeah, like you just said, and like we were talking about yesterday, I think we as a field in psychedelic therapy have learned how much it matters, because in formal psychedelic therapy, with eyeshades, headphones, and a therapist holding space, the only other stimulus you introduce is the music.
Right.
And that's the hidden therapist. That's the wind in the sails of the journey.
It seems obvious, right? Yeah. It's like a huge influence.
Yeah.
It's like massive. And it's for some, it's just that's why I keep like scratching my head. It's like, I can't, it's just odd. Yeah. Right? That panel yesterday, like, it's not really being talked about other than like yeah. the conversation we just had. And it just seems like I keep waving my hand about it. Let's talk about the experience itself and ceremony and the role. And maybe it's because it is an experiment when we bring it into modern kind of Western work like this. There actually isn't a lot to lean on to say, like,
yeah,
we're kind of trying to build something.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting, like, there's sort of a chicken and egg moment yeah. as well, where, like, practitioners and people who are doing this work, they understand that. And I think more and more and more so. But the general population, especially in America and up in Canada as well, you know, their introduction to like psychedelics will be like, oh, maybe I did something recreationally at a party or whatever. And then like maybe there's been a personal deep dive where they've like cobbled together a playlist or whatever, and they've done it that way. And a lot of people haven't had the opportunity to like really
They don't know.
They don't know.
I didn't know. Right? I mean, I'm in a very strange, specialized position. It's like those first experiences that inspired me were just songs I was listening to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, grace, spirit, it doesn't discriminate in the sense that it finds you when it can find you, however yeah. it needs to find you.
Yeah.
It's like, we're just thinking, like, as we said, like when we bring this into commerce, then it gets to be like, all right, how do we put this circle into the square?
Yeah.
There's ways, but it's a learning process.
Well, and that's kind of been our hope with like what we've been trying to curate with Numinous as well, and like supporting the tour and stuff like that, is you gotta try and lead people to it through the actual experience of yeah. it as well. And you know, I know for me, my first ayahuasca ceremonies were all with recorded music.
Oh, really?
And it was profound for me. And then I had an ayahuasca ceremony where it was like with Ikaros, and like, and I was like, mm-hmm. This is a whole, like, that was like, this was like kindergarten compared to like what this is really
yeah, it's
actually.
Like
a yeah, it's a yeah, whole, I mean, and yeah. yeah, whole different thing. But I would never have understood it in the way that I deeply understood it by through experience. And I mean, Reed, you talked about this, like, now having even clients be like, can you play the East Forest album? Can you, mm-hmm. you know, can, like there's.
And I don't want to stop. I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't want to stop whatever healing needs to happen. I mean, the truth is, I'm like, whatever helps people, I want to help people. Cause I just, mm-hmm. that's what I want to do. And I hate that there could be anything in the way of that too.
But I think it's important to try and inspire that, like, you know, as an organization, we pay for a certain kind of chair. We pay for a certain kind of, you know, like there's all these aspects that go into like, what is the financial commitment to building a space for somebody to go through this, right? And then to your point, like the music is such an important key part of that. And not only that, but how do we help inspire and build more of that too? So like other artists and mm-hmm. you know, there's always this conversation that comes in around access and equitable access. I think, like, and we talk about this even with therapist training, we make sure all of our therapists have cultural safety and humility training so that there's diversity in regards to like being able to connect with people, right? And we also have to inspire that, I think, in the music as well. And I mean, Charlotte talked about this really beautifully yesterday around like ancestral lineages and creating music that can really tap into some of that too, right? And I think, again, just the more openness and the more access we can create for people, the more people can find their pathway into like what's really, really healing and beneficial for them too.
Maybe we can chat about some of those principles from what you've learned and what research is starting to shine a light on, what the ceremonial, like indigenous groups have known for eons is, you know, the arc of the journey matters, right? Like we were talking about yesterday, you might at the beginning set a safe container through the music. You might at a peak or plateau of intensity start to crack people open with a certain kind of music. And at the end, you may help people enter their body or ground, and maybe novelty matters, and maybe lyrics can be distracting but useful at times. I'm wondering, like, what have you learned through the years of creating for this purpose that you might share with others?
I mean, all those things are true, but I think just my personal process isn't one that necessarily other folks have to do. I just find that improvising in that space is the way it works for me. And so it's a matter of responding artistically to what you're sensing and feeling.
Yeah.
And that's a little harder to be scientific about. I mean, I can pick it apart and say some things I notice that I do, or musical things that I tend to do. And some of those things are like, there's musical things that's sort of keeping it kind of modal, so it's not fully minor or major. It's sort of dancing in this middle ground of undefined emotive quality, and so you can then put a little more of like your own self of what you want onto it. In a way, it's in between that space of happy and sad, but at times you go maybe into the minor or maybe into the major, and so that again is part of that tension and release of, I mean, most music does this, but where you're kind of creating a kind of friction with sounds and layers that then can like release, and that happens in between songs. So it's almost like circles within circles. Yeah. And that really helps a journey itself. Just for the songs to be slowly coming on and have more of a form and come down over 15, 20, 30 minutes, I think is great. Because particularly with mushrooms, and a lot of this you'll find analogs with other medicines, but the music, especially when in a dark space or with an eye shade, it becomes the architecture of your experience, and sometimes synesthetically it becomes the experience. And so having each song in a way is like a chapter, it's like a room that you enter, and it's helpful to have enough time to be in that space to do the work and have it, have time, like space and rest in between. And so there's many, many things like that you just learn over time, that it's how to help guide the experience with music, even like the instrumentation, or like if there is a lyric, when and how, and sparingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the medicine matters to a certain extent, right? I've always been struck by even the non-classic psychedelics, ketamine, MDMA, and say psilocybin, LSD, they're more similar than different in terms of like the experience of music, the emotion of music, the embodiment of it is lit up way more on any of these medicines. But there are different kind of time components. Perhaps ketamine has this unique ability at a certain dose to like get time out of the equation, and music is just like you might zoom in on it, you're just there. I'm wondering how you experience things like ketamine and music versus psilocybin, that some people say carries you through that processing journey a little more than where ketamine, like it's the music is just right there as part of the texture of your experience, even more drastically.
I wrote from psilocybin because that was my teacher. That was our process. And then I would hear from people that it was working really well for them in MDMA sessions, or even LSD, or some people like ayahuasca. And I'd be like, well, I'm not trying to take over a lineage like ayahuasca, for instance, that has a very clear cultural lineage. Nonetheless, if it works, it works. But ketamine, I did start to write for a bit, specifically only because my partner Radha started doing work as a ketamine therapist, and I had access, and I was doing ketamine therapy. And so I would just literally be working. I was working on my second follow-up to Music for Mushrooms called In. Mm-hmm. And as I was working on it, I'd bring it in, and she was using it with a lot of clients. Just to be like, let's test it out. It's still psychedelic therapy. And so I was definitely being informed by the ketamine space. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it's wholly different, but I found that, like, I have a one-hour version of Music for Mushrooms called Spores, and that album works really well in the ketamine space. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason is because each of the songs are a little more, like, compact, like 6 minutes or 7 minutes, and it moves a little, the flow is faster, and the music itself is the same music, and I found that that actually worked really well in ketamine. And so she uses that record a lot in ketamine.
Cool. Huh, amazing. I liked your question yesterday, Peyton, about some wild and crazy personal stories with music and the psychedelic experience, or that we've observed. Anything you want to share?
Yeah, I think... one was, and my partner Victoria, she was going through this process, and she did a MDMA session, and you know, it was one of her first kind of experiences, and I was super curious after, as always, how it all went, and I was asking her, I was like, how'd it go? And she's like, we had this one moment, and I, you know, they played a Beyonce song. And that was just like the thing that just cracked for her, right? And I had at this time for me, I had this real connection to like the indigenous experience and the traditional cultural experience, and it was interesting. Like that was just that song and that moment for her provided the way she would articulate it, is like this liberation of like being able to drop into that. And I think it was also something that was known for her at a moment that provided that. And so, you know, I even reflect on that in the moments where you include nature sounds and stuff like that, like these universal, like known sounds that we have that provide that like safety and comfort to really drop in too. And, you know, it was interesting like to hear that and go like, Beyonce.
And if you think about it, like, it kind of makes sense too on the level of like, it's the music that is this magical like pairing of relationships and time that is what music is, right? And so there's just all any shape it takes, it's still music. That's the thing, that's like the fact that we can hear that relationship of sound and time, and it does things for us emotionally. Mm-hmm. That's what, if you really step back from it, it's so cool. And what is that? What does it do for us? It's a bridge. Music is a kind of bridge for us to be able to get in touch with the ineffable, with the numinous. And, you know, Matthew Fox, I love this quote of his when he's on my podcast. He said, you know, when you experience a mystical experience, the only real response you can give is either silence or art. And it makes sense to me because there's nothing you can say. You can't put your finger on it. And art, or music is art, is a way, it's a way of us getting in touch with the periphery of all that is not just three-dimensional. So it's a kind of translator, and it's a kind of carrier of that thing. And that's why it turns us on so much, because that's part of us that we're hungry for too. So Beyonce, any music, but certainly Beyonce, of course, is using those same things, those same tools. So for some people, that's like gives them that comfort level, and it does the trick for them.
Yeah, it does make sense, even from like a brain science standpoint. I mean, sound waves come in, hit the eardrum. They go through this elaborate machinery in our inner ear, like the cochlea, and it's different chambers that vibrate differently to different tones and pitches. And then it all sends this sound through your acoustic neuronal system, but to different areas of the brain, like language centers, emotional centers, autobiographical memory, like you're saying. So we end up through life, because music is everywhere, with it woven into our identities and our emotions. And it's like this portal that we can unlock, especially with a psychedelic. You bring a psychedelic that's a full sensory experience, lighting those up even more, and music, it's going to transport you back. And in that way, if you've heard Beyonce at a certain time, or if that brings up a kind of a fight song in you, some empowered, healthy, empowered anger, you might just transform some like shame or pain or whatever into anger with the help of the music and the medicine, for example.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's wild. And in that note, like, because it hits the language centers, and language is so symbolic of images, times, people, relationship, it's it's amazing what it can do, even if there are lyrics in it. Although I think we're noticing, like you've said, the instrumental ambient and the novelty of it is a nice way to have that default experience. It's like dissolving structures of ego and getting out some of the distractions. But sometimes that one like trigger of something could be exactly what someone needs to symbolize a time and a place or a person or a relationship.
And those synchronicities that make those moments that true magic, usually is the other person who's in service to create that happening has no idea that they're like, it's just something they said.
Beyonce.
Like or those little girls in the labyrinth. I mean, you know, that's the beauty. That's the art piece that we have to stand back. And that's where you're always just like, wow.
Well, I think that's true service too. True service is like that moment of like pure inspiration and then offering that, right? I think that's really cool.
We don't always have to know up here like how it all works.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I certainly don't.
And if people pretend to know, they're probably fooling themselves.
That's right.
Yeah, it's another thing the medicine does is just help us realize how much we don't know. Well, amazing. Anything else to share from either of you or add on the topic of music as medicine?
Of course, music is medicine and celebration. And so I think it's, you know, it's so ever present in our world. It makes a lot of sense to dive into it more fully in these spaces consciously and support it, because I think it'll only give us more like wealth and riches and cool experiences and just make everything better. So it's not like a chore, like, oh, we have to figure this out. It's more like explore, play. And that's what it's always been, and innovate and allow, give people time and spaces to do that. And we'll see even more amazing, especially with all the technological options we have to make music. It'll be get cooler and cooler.
And I just want to say thank you for your music and your art. You heard yesterday in a number of different ways from people after, like, how it's touched them or how important it was in part of their journey. And I've seen it being on the front lines of this, and as you know, your work shows up on so many of the playlists, even the 12-hour LSD study playlist we were talking about yesterday. And I've seen moments with someone struggling or on the cusp of something, and then how neat is it that what you made back then without knowing what it would become was so helpful in getting them to the other side of that, or getting them, helping them transform their life in a positive way. So yeah, thank you for what you do. It's really inspiring. Yeah.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. It's been fun.
Thank you. Likewise.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.